This is John Howell Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Alderman Matt O'Shea joins us now, 19th Ward Alderman. He has introduced an ordinance to hopefully prevent assaults of Chicago paramedics, first responders, emergency workers. And Alderman, thank you for your time, sir. Much appreciated. I think everybody can get behind this ordinance. I'm hoping you have full support. What is the status of the ordinance?
So, John, I introduced this ordinance last week at Chicago City Council. It was immediately sent to the Committee on Public Safety, where I hope to get a hearing before our next City Council meeting on February 1st. Right now I have about 20 of my colleagues signed on, but I hope to expand that and get more. This is common sense. We cannot have our first responders, our paramedics, being attacked while they're attempting to render aid, and in many cases, save lives.
How big of a problem has this become?
Well, it's interesting. The Center for Disease Control has a study out there that attacks on emergency medical service providers is up significantly over the past 5 years. And I know, just in speaking with paramedics here with the Chicago Fire Department and Firefighters Local 2, the union that represents them, we've had several very serious attacks on paramedics just in recent months, most recently New Year's Eve. John, these folks are responding to shooting incidents, domestic violence incidents, gang conflict in rough neighborhoods in the middle of the night. When you couple that with our significant shortage of police, they're out there alone with no protection. You know, paramedics don't carry sidearms. And so there they are trying to render aid, and many times, you know, a confined space at the back of an ambulance, and all of a sudden they're getting attacked, beaten. This is a very serious issue that we need to address.
So they would face a fine of $1,000 and a minimum sentence of 90 days in jail. Just to clarify, are these primarily, you know, criminals, gangbangers, people that are taking issue with what the EMTs are trying to do, or are these mentally ill people that are just going nuts? It's more of a crime issue than a mental health issue, yes?
Yes, I mean, it's both those scenarios that you just described. But, you know, this is the ordinance that I'm writing for the city of Chicago. The state of Illinois also has penalties for this. So this is just enhancing for the crime. The other thing that we need to do is we need to put placards on these ambulances stating that if, in fact, you attack an emergency medical service provider, that you will be held accountable. And I think we need to carry it even further. I think we need to have a public relations campaign, making the public aware. And I think we also need to look at possibly expanding the use of cameras in some situations to help protect them.
Alderman Matt O'Shea is here from the 19th Ward. I'm working downtown most days now. A lot of people returning to work after COVID. The city is a different place for me. I work at the NBC Tower, so I'm right in River North, but it's different. And arrests are down 80%. How are things on the south side along the businesses on Western Avenue? Are they recovering, and is crime diminishing on the south side?
Well, I think first and foremost, John, crime is not diminishing anywhere. Crime is up significantly over the past few years. When you couple that with nearly 1,700 less police officers to combat that crime, these are difficult times here in the city of Chicago, and not enough people, when I say people, I'm talking about elected officials, are talking about crime. And until we get this crime situation under control, we're going to continue to see tourism down, people looking to leave communities, entrepreneurs not willing to invest in communities, developers not willing to invest in communities. This is a very serious problem that needs more attention and more people speaking out and talking about it, John.
Do you hear any of the mayoral candidates with a viable plan to cut down on crime?
I mean, we're starting to hear more of these candidates talk about it. Just the simple fact that people need to start acknowledging it. Yes, crime is up, police officers are down, and we're not prosecuting people. We're not holding people accountable. I'm not talking about lightweight crimes, nickel and dime stuff. I'm talking about people who have committed gun crimes in the past, violent offenders, given bracelets and set free out on the street, where they're continuing to victimize people, where they're continuing to harass and terrorize people. We see it each and every week in our city.
Electronic monitoring, should that be reserved for first-time offenders who have not yet been convicted?
I think that electronic monitoring should be an option for the judicial branch when someone does not have a violent past, having committed gun crimes, someone who is committing misdemeanor offenses or nonviolent offenses. But if you commit a crime with a gun, you should be held accountable. And you should be detained.
Are you looking forward to the Southside Irish Parade?
You know, it's. I think we're about 9 weeks out. It's going to be here before we know it, and it's usually the first sign that spring is on the way. I look forward to spending Southside Irish St. Patrick's Day Parade here, seeing the community out and about.
I've ordered a brand new, beautiful green derby to wear that day.
Well, I look forward to seeing you in that bad boy there, John.
I've been forced to get rid of the green suit that I had for many, many years, but I'm still going to wear the green derby.
Okay, well, I'm going to have something that day, and I'm going to invite you to it, and I hope you come by with that green derby.
I will do so, sir. Thanks for your time. Continued success. Good luck on the South Side. We appreciate it, Alderman.
Thanks, John. Be well.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
The state's attorney or the prosecutors have charged actor Alec Baldwin with not one, but two involuntary manslaughter charges. And I imagine Alec Baldwin's defense team is already disappointed that he decided, probably against their advice, to go talk about this quite a while ago with George Stephanopoulos on ABC.
It wasn't in the script for the trigger to be pulled.
Well, the trigger wasn't pulled. I didn't pull the trigger.
So you never pulled the trigger?
No. I would never point a gun at anyone and pull a trigger at them, never.
Now, to my knowledge, the FBI tested that gun, which Alec Baldwin thought was empty or cold or loaded with blanks at the very worst, and he would never pull the trigger, and yet the FBI has tested the gun and said, no, trigger was pulled.
The gun was supposed to be empty. I was told I was handed an empty gun. If there were cosmetic rounds, nothing with a charge at all, a flash round, nothing. She goes down. I thought to myself, did she faint? The notion that there was a live round in that gun did not dawn on me till probably 45 minutes to an hour later.
Our next guest is an expert. In fact, he is among the top 30 trial lawyers in the United States. More than 50 years of experience, both civil and criminal trial work. Has deep knowledge about cases like this, what the procedures are, how guns are supposed to be handled. He has tried criminal negligence cases like the one that Baldwin is charged with. In fact, we've talked about this. We talked about this case this older case when the Baldwin incident happened. Our guest represented the producers of the movie The Crow, Brandon Lee. While filming The Crow was in a scene, blanks were to be fired at him. Instead, the gun contained a partial bullet, which went into Mr. Lee. He was killed. Let's welcome Jim Brosnahan. He's out in San Francisco, a legendary legal analyst. Mr. Brosnahan, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be with you.
First off, was it a mistake for Alec Baldwin, who had a right to remain silent, but apparently did not have the ability to go talk about this with George Stephanopoulos?
Yeah, it is better for a defendant to not be talking to the press. The lawyer sometimes will talk to the press. And what happened here is suddenly the trigger, as you just made it rightly, a central issue. I think there is a good issue that he has, though, on looking at it from the defense standpoint, and that is quite simply that he thought that gun was a safe gun. How could he think otherwise? When you think about, I just want to make one point, when you think about all the shooting that goes into all the movies, it's on television and in theaters, how many shots are fired in the course of a week? And why is that? Because they're all blanks. They're supposed to be blanks. So I would like that as a defense. We had that in Lee's case. It was a sad case like this one. He was dead before he hit the floor. The people there that day thought that it was one of the great death scenes they had seen. And, of course, I watched the movie 10 times. And in that case, we were able to convince the district attorney that's a tragic accident. It doesn't have to be somebody guilty of something for there to be an accident. So that was the argument.
The guns, in both cases, if the guns are on the street, any other situation, you're holding a gun, even if you think it's empty, you shoot it at somebody, you're responsible. But in the situation of a prop during the filming of a movie, is that still considered to be a gun or just a bad prop?
It's a prop. Everybody knows it's a prop. They know that, though, because someone else, not the actor, has checked it several times. But there's also a procedure, at least there was in the Brandon case, where when you bring the gun up and point it and fire it, you don't point it at the individual. When you do that, you bring it up, and just to the right of the person you fire. The sad thing in that case was that the shooter didn't do that and felt horrible, just terrible about it. He really had a tough time after that. But so, yeah, you're handed something. Negligence is not simple, but negligence is you know there's a danger, and you go ahead anyway. And the example I've been giving to people who asked me is that you know that you know that the speed limit is 70. You see the sign, then you go 100. But in your head, you know there's danger. Why would he think there was danger when he's handed a prop that's been, as far as he knows, examined by other people? Anyway, That's one argument I would imagine he will make.
Jim Brosnahan is here, legendary legal analyst. We're talking about the Baldwin case. In that case, the second involuntary manslaughter charge with a firearm component to it, is that DA overreach? Is that a heavy charge to entice Baldwin to cop a plea?
It could be. There's an awful lot of that that goes on. It depends on the integrity, really. I think that's the right word, of the district attorney. But there's an awful lot of overcharging and all of that. You know, forecasting the future is not my thing, because life happens. But I would guess that Mr. Baldwin will go to trial. And I would think that he evidently has a good lawyer. I think that would be a fascinating trial, and I would think that it would be one of these even-up kind of cases. It could go either way. It is true what you said, though. I just want to add, by the way, that, you know, someone was killed. I mean, that's a terrible mood in the courtroom.
As a quote-unquote producer of Rust, what additional legal jeopardy might Baldwin face?
Well,
if he was on the management team that hired the armorer, who's also charged with two counts of involuntary manslaughter, she is, as a producer, his fingerprints are on that hire. His fingerprints are on that movie set in addition to just being an actor.
Depends on what kind of producer he is. For example, there certainly are producers that put money forward, and that's all they do. They don't run the thing. So if his job was to have his name listed as a producer, whatever, when he negotiated, it depends all on, if he was running it minute by minute, and he had direct control over the people who were supposed to check the gun, But I doubt that, by the way. I doubt it. But that would be very interesting, and that would be an additional good argument by the prosecution.
Jim Brosnahan, thank you for the legal analysis. Before you go, that's a pretty impressive third-string quarterback you have for your 49ers.
To say that we're excited is to put it mildly. This kid, he's 23. He's got it all, and he's got the poise. And, you know, we kind of keep hoping that he won't fall apart, and he just doesn't. He's as cool as some of the great players you've had in Chicago over the years. I mean, that's his world out there on that field. So we have hopes. We got to play Philadelphia this weekend, and Philadelphia is very, very good.
He reminded me of John Brody. Not so much Montana, not so much Kelly, but John Brody.
I remember John Brody because I'm a man of maturity, and I loved to watch him. He was really great. He didn't necessarily have the team that Purdy has. This team really is good. They've got defense. They've got offense.
They have a pretty good place kicker that apparently the Bears do not need.
And he's kicked some sensational kicks. Yeah.
Made a great tackle yesterday too.
It was all about kicking for a while.
Yeah. Mr. Brosnahan, thank you, sir. We'll call on your legal analysis and football acumen in the future.
Thank you. It's so nice to talk to you.
Take care.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Well, I guess we used to say we were shocked by these sorts of things. I guess we were surprised, but not shocked. The latest spree shooting out in Los Angeles. Authorities are still looking for a motive by the gunman who killed, I think, 11 people. One died this afternoon, if I'm not mistaken, at a Los Angeles area ballroom. It was a dance club, during the Lunar New Year celebrations. The suspect was 72 years old, no known criminal record. He was found dead yesterday. The shootings took place late on Saturday. He was found dead yesterday of a self-inflicted gunshot wound not far from LAX. Alex Stone has been working this story since the beginning out in Los Angeles, a regular contributor to our program. Alex, what do we know this afternoon?
Well, a lot going on now, John, and we're about to get an update in about 40 minutes. Investigators are going to come out, and we understand they don't have a lot that's going to be new, but update on where they are, and you're right. Another person died today, so it is 11. There are a few more who are in the hospital. But bottom line, they don't know the motive in this. We are now hearing from a senior federal source that they are beginning to make comparisons already to Las Vegas in 2017, when, remember, it was an older man, had anger issues, but they never really got to a motive. Initially, here it looked like domestic violence, but now we find out that he divorced his wife almost 20 years ago. So maybe he was trying to find her. There's no indication that she was here, that she was a victim, a witness, any of that. Tenet tells us that he was lonely. He distrusted everybody, came to these two dance ballrooms a lot, loved to dance, but beyond that, he was just kind of an old, grumpy guy, 72 years old, who can Tran, as they look for the motive in this. And Fonda Kwan's aunt was shot in her car leaving, coming in, and she told us this today.
Alex?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We didn't get that feed of the actuality.
Oh, that's odd that you weren't hearing. Anyway, bottom line, she was saying that her aunt was sitting in the passenger seat, was shot trying to pull out. That he wasn't wearing any kind of disguise, wasn't doing anything to try to cover his face. In the end, they don't know at this point what it was.
Are the authorities saying that there's any? I know that a lot of the victims are Asian American. Apparently, the shooter also Asian American. Are they willing to call this a hate crime, or they're not going that far?
No, they don't know what this was yet. And initially, they thought, well, maybe it was a hate crime, but it doesn't necessarily look like it was. This is a predominantly Asian community here. But he was part of the community. So was there a hate aspect to it? There was a shooting at a church in Orange County, California, about a year ago, where it was a Taiwanese man who went in and killed people in a Chinese church because of the conflict between Taiwan and China. That turned out to be a hate crime, but it was violence within the Asian American community. So they're still trying to put all that together.
And there was a second attack planned, they thought. And tell us the hero aspect to this story.
Yeah, so just down the street, another shooting that was apparently about to unfold. Gunman walked in to another dance studio. The owner of that dance studio, young man, saw the gun. They wrestled over the gun. He says it was a fight for his life, that even though the guy was 72 years old, that he fought hard and beat the gentleman's name is Brandon Say, beat Brandon Say with that gun, pistol whipped him. They fought over it. And finally, Tran gave up. And in that moment, he thought he was going to come back for more. And Brandon Say was telling us that he thought in that moment on Saturday night, he was going to have to kill a man. I mean, he's never killed a man in his life, that he was going to have to kill another human being to stay alive. And then Tran ran off and got in his van and took off and then was found number hours later and killed himself. But now Brandon Say is being called a hero in this whole thing, that he stopped him, he disarmed him, he was willing to fight him, and ended what was probably another version of what went on here at this dance club.
Thank you, sir. Much appreciated for the update. You know, back to the shooter in Vegas, you're right. Nobody's ever been able to determine his motive, and they were just all country music fans. And he had actually cased Lollapalooza here in Chicago before committing the atrocity in Las Vegas.
Yeah, and in that one, I mean, I was there that night. That was a horrific night, and we'll probably never know an answer to that one. This one we probably will, but as of right now, that there's nothing glaring. Maybe it was domestic violence, maybe it was mental, something else, but right now they don't know.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate your time.
You got it. Thanks, John.
Take care.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
There's an editorial that I found at Bloomberg, and I go to Bloomberg two or three times a week, and the headline caught my eye. And before we get to Elizabeth talking about this, the debt ceiling nonsense has gone on long enough. If you want to go to Bloomberg and read the entire piece, you can. Let me just give you the first and last paragraphs. The farce demands that this dire result gets averted at the very last moment. But it might be unwise to take this for granted. When it comes to incompetence, the U.S. Congress leaves no path unexplored. When this pantomime was last played through almost to the end in 2011, default was indeed avoided. But financial markets were destabilized, the country's credit rating was cut, and taxpayers faced nearly $20 billion in additional borrowing costs, which we spent. We didn't get that back. People who want to take it to the brink say, well, this is fiscal discipline. Now, in fact, Bloomberg pointed out, one analysis found that every major deficit reduction deal between 85 and 2011 did result from these fights. Yet, if the debt limit was ever an effective tool, it no longer is, because even with the brinkmanship, debt has increased to roughly 95% of gross domestic product. Wow. So avoiding such needless disasters should be a priority. And even if such ideas continue to go nowhere, and they point out two or three different ideas to avoid this, Democrats and Republicans can surely agree on two things. First, public debt cannot safely be allowed to keep rising at projected rates. No kidding. And second, purporting to solve this problem by threatening to default on the country's obligation is just pure nuts. Now we welcome Elizabeth back to the program, Elizabeth Schulze. She's watching this in D.C. today. Well, the White House and Kevin McCarthy are trading statements back and forth saying that they're willing to meet, perhaps, to discuss a debt limit. Elizabeth, can this be considered progress in this political environment?
You know, it's a step in the direction of a meeting, which would be progress, given that both sides at this point have kind of staked out their positions and have not shown any willingness to budge. But until there's a date for this meeting, a place, a time, you know, it's hard to say that there's any real momentum on this issue. You know, right now, the White House is digging in. We hear President Biden and the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, again reiterating that the White House does not want to negotiate on this question of raising the debt ceiling. Their position is that the U.S. is already up against that borrowing limit. We're having to take extraordinary measures to try to not pass that borrowing limit right now and risk a U.S. debt default. And the White House says Congress needs to come together in a bipartisan way, raise that limit as they've done dozens of times before, including 2 years ago under President Biden and several times under former President Trump. But you've got Kevin McCarthy, the House Speaker, really kind of standing the line, saying he is not going to get his Republicans in the House to vote to raise the debt limit until there is also an agreement to cut government spending. So as of today, not any sense that there's a way that these two sides are going to meet in the middle. And it is certainly getting more questionable. This standoff seems like it's going to be kind of more drawn out than we've seen in these battles over the debt limit. We've seen a lot of them in the past, but this time it seems both sides are digging in a little bit more than we've seen, at least in recent years.
Okay, this is a big question, but take a shot at an answer. What happens in June?
Right. So the worst case scenario, the dire scenario that Yellen, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says would be calamity, is if the U.S. actually defaults on its debt. In other words, it cannot pay its bills. And that means that it cannot meet its obligations to people who hold U.S. debt. So if you own bonds in your 401k, for example, you know, it would not be able to pay out those investors. But also the government wouldn't be able to make payments for Social Security, for Medicare, for military salaries, tax refunds, so many parts of the economy that rely on payments from the government. It's a huge chunk of the overall growth of the economy. Basically, the question is the government being able to do that at all would be put at risk, not to mention the whole kind of notion that the full faith and credit of the United States government would be jeopardized. So when we got close to this scenario back in 2011, the U.S. credit rating was downgraded. That's something that had never happened before. This idea that the U.S. government was a safe haven, a place where you can store your money and get paid back, that would be put into doubt. And it really, that would have a big ripple effect across the global economy.
Do you think someplace in Florida, perhaps today, John Boehner is sitting back with a glass of wine and a cigarette just saying, I told you people so. I told you this was going to happen again. You should have taken the big deal, the big compromise.
I think that's a very likely scenario. You know, you see that this battle has been played out time and time again. But the problem with this using the debt limit as a bargaining token, as we just laid out, is that the stakes are so high. You know, there's an agreement among economists, you know, people who watch the financial markets who I talk to just say this really isn't something that you want to be messing with. We're talking about paying people Social Security and Medicare. Is that really worth kind of this bargaining chip? Sure, it's fair to have this debate about future spending with the government, but that's a separate conversation than the government paying the bills that it already owes.
There are some people that love to see things burn down, though.
That's for sure. There are a lot of people here in Washington who like to take the other side just to take the other side. And, you know, they like to have their opinions heard. You know, part of Kevin McCarthy's problem here is that, you know, hardline conservatives are taking out this position that they want cuts to be made, including to entitlements, to Social Security, and to Medicare. That is a politically very risky move, but McCarthy has to listen to all the members of his caucus because he has such a narrow majority in the House right now. He doesn't want to alienate anyone, at least not quite yet.
Elizabeth Schulze, thank you very much for the analysis. We appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks so much for having me.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
The Rolling Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.